Hey, welcome to another edition of Old School Guns, the podcast that tells you like it is. This is episode 29. So we're almost at 30, almost at that milestone of 30. So anyway, let's get into some stuff. First of all, I apologize to those people who've been trying to hit the follower tab or the like tab. Apparently, I don't know what it is with Podbean. I don't know if you have to have a Podbean account. If you know anything about Podbean, it's this podcasting for the masses kind of website that helps you get started in podcasting. And the allure of it is that you don't really need a whole lot of technical expertise, which is why I chose it. And you don't have to, you know, fumble around and learn a lot of complicated software. But the downside of that is it's sort of like the McDonald's of podcasting. I mean, it is what it is. And it's kind of a low capability deal. So I apologize if you're hitting that like button or you're hitting the follow button and you're not getting notified. It works. It works for me, but that's probably because I have a Podbean account. So a lot of times it's hard for me to test things because I automatically go and it automatically logs me into the account. So what might work for me might not work for you. As a related matter, you're going to love this. As a related matter, of course, I now have the podcast on iTunes. Podcast on iTunes. So here's what the deal is. You know, you go through this thing, and Podbean has this little template they take you through, and you put in certain information, and then you have to have a iTunes account, so you have that, and then you go ahead and put in some information there, and essentially you hit a validate button. Well, most of the time, your validate button doesn't validate because your artwork is not the correct size. So if you're like me, I don't really do a lot of computer graphic stuff, so I had to figure out how to make it 1400 pixels by 1400 pixels, and it actually looks kind of crappy because now it's kind of fuzzy, but it works. It got me by there, so it's good enough for government work. It got me by the barrier. So anyway, once you get it there, then they put it under review, and they say 24 to 72 hours. Well, all of a sudden, it was coming up on 3 days later, and I hadn't heard boo from them. So I figure, well, you know, I'll just give it another day. And but lo and behold, a couple hours later, I get this acceptance, at least that's what I think it was, an acceptance email from iTunes, except it's in French. The whole thing's in French. And I go, I can't read this. I never studied romance languages, so, you know, sorry, I cannot read this. And I probably could have tried to copy it and put it into Google Translate or something, but I wrote them back respectfully and said, hey, I'm really sorry, but, you know, I'm in the Midwest. I don't speak French. I don't know anybody who speaks French. I've never received anything in French. And I don't know why you would send me an acceptance, iTunes acceptance in French. And so then I get back this thing saying, well, can you send us a screenshot of the email? I don't know why I have to do that since they sent it. They're obviously too lazy to go look it up. And then they want to know, what's your iOS number? What's your device? Are you configured for English? What's your time code setting? And it's like, you know, I sent them the screenshot and I said, hey, here's what it is. You know, I'm pretty sure my system's set to English since everything else I've gotten ever is in English except for this email. So therefore, you know, I think it's a pretty good shot that everything's set up right. And so I sent him that and I'm like, I'm not going to look up this other nonsense. I'm just not going to do it. Then I get a thing back going, well, we need your iOS. And at that point, I'm not even answering the email anymore. It's like, all I asked them for was, hey, I don't know anybody who speaks French or anything. Can you send me this thing in English so I can read it and make sure I'm in compliance, make sure I do everything that this email tells me to do? I don't think it tells me to do very much, but just send me the English copy. That's simple courtesy. But instead, all I get is this technobabble BS pushback. It's actually funny. You know, so all I gotta say is Podbean is pretty much podcasting for the masses, and you know, frankly, iTunes is messed up, man. It is there. Supposedly, I'm there. Now, when I go to iTunes and try to search, I can't find anything. So I did Google it, and they said, well, after you're there, it takes a few days to become visible. So we'll see. So if you do iTunes, and frankly, I have nothing to do with iTunes, but if you do iTunes, it should be on there if you can find it, and hopefully it won't be in French. You know, they seem to think I speak and read and write in French. So I don't know what else, if they've put my podcast through a translation program or something. But yeah, definitely, if you do read and know French, then you're going to be good to go. If you don't, well, then I'd go to Podbean and you can just get it straight there. So anyway, that's the adventure with the podcasting. And that's almost as good as, you know, I was really intrigued. There was a last couple days, there's been a really good series of articles about people speculating about Donald Trump wanting to buy Greenland. And frankly, I think it's a good idea. I think buying Greenland would be an absolutely outstanding idea because, number one, there'd be incredible amount of room for shooting ranges. I mean, you know, you talk about just having just unlimited land for shooting ranges. Greenland's got it, man. I mean, it might be cold, but it's got it. Number two, I believe it's owned by Denmark, and they're not exactly shrewd businessmen because they're the people who they kept Greenland, which is covered with ice, and sold us the Virgin Islands years ago, which are in the Caribbean. So I don't know. If I had to keep one and sell the other, I think I would have kept the Virgin Islands, and I probably would have sold Greenland. So Greenland may still be on the market because they're not really all that shrewd. Now, if they're not going to sell it, we do have some other options. And I mean, we've got some very cool real estate options that we could do. Basically, you know, I've been to Denmark once. It's cold there. You know, even in the summer, it's kind of rainy and cold, you know. And they can have some nice days, but it's like Germany. It's got a lot of cloudy and rainy weather during the summer. So we could arrange some kind of a trade. Now, we might have to throw in some cash, but Puerto Rico for Greenland might be something that they're interested in. I mean, they could go there, it's warm, it's in the Caribbean, they can go to other islands and see stuff. I'd be pretty good. So maybe Puerto Rico for Greenland would be something that we could interest them in. A few other things that we got out there. There's lots of land in places like Nevada. You know, that kind of western Utah, you know, some of that land is not very well populated. So we could trade them a big chunk of that, and it's warm. They could go there, they could build stuff, and they could be a great vacation place for them. Close to Vegas. You know, they could even hop over into the People's Republic of California and, you know, tour Hollywood and Universal Studios and that kind of stuff. So maybe some of that land, which we're really not using very much, you know, especially now that the jig's up on Area 51. Everybody knows what's happened there, so we can't do anything secret there anymore. So we got a lot of space out there that we could trade for Greenland. Probably the lowest thing we could do. And they would have to really be suckers to go for this. We could probably trade them Baltimore, Cleveland. Yeah, Baltimore, Cleveland. What are some other places? Akron, Ohio. We could trade them that. We could trade them part of Kansas City. There's a part of that that we don't need anymore. Let's see. There's a lot of Los Angeles. You know, actually, a better idea, much better idea is we could trade them California. We could trade them California for Greenland would be a really super good deal. And I could really get behind that. California for Greenland, perfect. And in fact, maybe if they don't want to give up Greenland, maybe we could just like give them California. Just basically not even get anything in return. Just take nothing in return. Trade it for nothing. We could get rid of California. Yeah, California for Greenland would be awesome. That would be very, very awesome. So maybe there's some options there for Donald Trump. It doesn't have to be a cash deal. I mean, we can definitely we got some land that we could definitely give up. Okay. All right, get back to something a little more serious. I just want to go ahead and clarify my position on the NRA vis-a-vis all this. As this podcast has evolved, my position has changed somewhat. I was pretty upset, as I said, the last podcast. You know, I was upset like a lot of people when I heard about the travel expenses and some of this other stuff that had happened. But, you know, as I've basically looked at it and reflected on it, it's like, if you see those as problems, there's a time and a place where we can handle those. And a guy who's been a great example to me is Willis Lee, who I supported for the NRA board. I think he's a great guy. He's a fellow retired lieutenant colonel like I am. He is a fighter. And if it's one thing that gun rights needs, it's fighters. And he's out there on Facebook, which is an unfriendly platform. But Willis Lee, and maybe he does play basketball well. Maybe he's as good as Willis Reed. I don't know. But Willis Lee is a fighter. He is a guy. He's not going to quit. He is not going to quit under any circumstances. He's going to continue to fight, and he's fighting exactly the right battle. He's fighting exactly the right people, and he's got exactly the right perspective. And his perspective is that this other stuff doesn't really matter very much. We have all got to stand shoulder to shoulder and protect the Second Amendment. This other stuff will get solved. This other stuff will get solved. And But I'm an NRA guy. I mean, I've been a member of the NRA for a long, long time, since I was a teenager. I've been a member, been a life member for a long time also. And that doesn't mean I completely endorse everything. Do I think that some bad decisions were made, at least bad in for optics and everything else? Yes, I do. However, those aren't important right now. I could care less about those. I care about Second Amendment rights for you, for me, and for people who I don't even know. I care about those Second Amendment rights, even for people who aren't currently exercising them, because someday they might. Someday they might. How many of us gun owners have a spouse who did not grow up with guns and was introduced to guns by us? And the answer is there's a lot. Now there's guys who've married gals and gals who've married guys who both of them were into shooting and shooting sports and the outdoors and everything before they were children. So, but there's also a lot of couples that one or the other, and it's usually the husband is into it and the wife is brought into it. That's been in my experience anyway. So there are a lot of people who've been brought into the gun culture and into the outdoors and into a lot of the sporting use of firearms and recreational use of firearms, as well as the defensive use of firearms by their significant other. And to bring this back to the point, these were people who were not exercising their Second Amendment rights early or during a portion of their early lives, and who have, as they've gotten married or as they've gotten more mature and become adults, choose to. And so we have a duty to the generations that are coming after us to preserve these rights, because they may want to exercise it. And there's people who are adults today who may get into shooting. I meet them all the time, people who decide they want to get into a sport past the traditional high impact sports years that most of us have. So, when you're approaching middle age or in middle age, it's a great sport that you can pick up and do well at and have a great time with. So, you know, we need to protect our rights for these people. So that's why I'm firmly backing the NRA. I'm firmly backing what they're doing, and I'm firmly backing the 2020 election effort that the NRA is putting forward. And, you know, I think that we all need to basically, whether you agree with it, like it or not, or have a problem with how they've spent money, send some money to the ILA, because you know the NRA, ILA will use the money for the legislative agenda of pro-gun rights, and that's what we need. We need gun rights first and foremost. We won't always have a Second Amendment friendly president, and we won't always have Second Amendment people in control of the Senate, or at least people we can influence. So we have to make some progress now, and we have to get some protections now. Okay, here's some flash news that might prove helpful. It appears that Classic Arms, and a lot of people kind of go back and forth. They don't like Classic Arms because, unfortunately, Classic Arms charges the going market rate for some of these guns. And if you're used to the $50 and $60 Moisen Nagant rifles, which now cost $300, you usually don't like Classic Arms very much. However, I think that they do have they're one of the last outlets for good surplus firearms. And one of the deals they have going on is the Zastava M70 for $149. And the M70 is a 32 ACP, looks kind of like a truncated, smaller version of a Tokarev-style pistol. I'm sure it's single stack. I'm sure it's looks to me like a single action automatic. I've not fired one. However, these are former police pistols and appear to be in very nice condition. So if you need a small, concealable, hideable gun, then 32 ACP will fill the bill for you. This is a good low-cost option. Frankly, I would buy one of these before I would buy a high-point pistol. That's just me, but usually something that's passed police or military testing has got durability and reliability that you really want in a self-defense firearm. And for not too much more, a couple of the outlets are, if you Google it, I'm sure you can find it. They're selling the Star BMs are sub $200. Now, they may not be looking really pretty on the outside, but they should be functional on the inside. And again, that's another gun I would kind of take in lieu of a high point, simply because while it may be used, it definitely has the quality. Star pistols are actually quite excellent pistols, as are the Zastava pistols. You know, they don't command a lot of oohs and ahs on the range, but they're functional. They get things done, and when you know, it's a lot better than not having a gun, and its reliability may be a very treasured quality when you need it. So those are two good deals that are out there now, and there's others, but those are the two that just kind of piqued my interest. Okay, another one. InRange TV is doing some sort of battle rifle test. You know, I kind of looked at the first few minutes of it, and frankly, I'm just not interested. When I see a couple of the testers, I think they had five testers, and I think two of them were left-handed. I think one or two of them may be women. I'm not really sure. You know, it just, one guy looked like a cop who looked like he could handle weapons. The rest, I wasn't really sure about. I'm not really into tests like this. I mean, you can rest assured that every test is going to be something that would be very friendly to an AR. So, you know, some weapons are not as ergonomic as an AR, and therefore they're just not going to do well, and you can probably go down the list. And some of the, they start back with the FAL, and they go up through the G3, the M1A, M14, on and on, that through the SCAR Heavy and the XCR, Robinson Arms XCR, and even the Brownell's clone of the original AR-10, a sweet looking rifle, by the way. But anyway, I just don't really think too much of those. There's a variety of reasons for that. Number one is rifles will do well what they're designed to do. And when you look at the FAL, let's just take three of them, the FAL, the G3, and the M14. And we've touched on this before. The M14 was designed to capitalize on the grand system, and it was designed to use the new cartridge that became the 7.62x51 and later adopted as a commercial cartridge as the 308 Winchester. It was designed to essentially equip an army that was very used to grand style weapons, and an army which had fought two successful wars with a grand style rifle. So consequently, it does exactly what it was supposed to do. The G3 was designed with a lot of experience from the Eastern Front on their minds, and it was designed to be easy to produce. Therefore, you have the stamped sheet metal. It was designed to work under very adverse conditions. Therefore, it uses that roller lock system, which is really impervious to cold and, resistant as much as any mechanical device can be to the intrusions of dust and dirt. And it was designed to use, wartime production ammunition, which may not be of the highest quality that there would be. And, it does all those things exceptionally well. Has excellent reliability and durability, but it does sacrifice some ergonomics. It just does. So that's the way that is. The FAL was designed to be sold around the world, and it has an adjustable gas system, so you could use different types of ammunition in it under different climactic challenges. So the different climactic conditions and the ammunition variability made an adjustable gas system. It made a lot of sense. So, if you kind of go into it with that, you kind of realize that the rest of the stuff they're doing is probably not very relevant. What makes it even more irrelevant is those weapons were designed to be used in squads, and they're squad level tactics. So it doesn't really matter if you can't put the magazine in quite as fast, because you have to rock it in, as you can with an AR. It just doesn't really matter, because there's supposed to be a squad of men using these things and not an individual competitor or an individual operator. And, some of the individual operator stuff came in with special operations forces and police, militarized police type forces, which really have been a kind of a Johnny come lately. When most of the battle rifles were designed, special operations forces either did not exist or they were quite small. And nowadays, obviously, it's a major component of every serious army in the world has got a pretty robust special operations capability. So they're designing equipment, yes, for that particular environment where a lone operator, the speed by which they can manipulate a rifle is quite important. Maybe not as important if you're the West German Army in 1965 and you're trying to blunt a Soviet invasion and you have squads and squads, companies, battalions, brigades, divisions fighting in a very large congested battlefield. And hey, if I run out of ammo, it's not a problem. I reload my rifle, but while I'm doing that, the rest of my squad is still firing, and maybe one or two other guys are reloading too, and when other people are reloading, I'm firing. That's kind of how they looked at that. Same thing with the Kalashnikov. The Kalashnikov was designed that you would have masses of troops, and if you've ever saw the old Soviet Army maneuvers, they would have hundreds of armored personnel carriers, and thousands and thousands of soldiers would dismount from them, and you weren't out there with an AK alone. Now, the fact that the AR platform, AR-15, M16, M4, whatever you want to call it, platform, and its derivatives, even going down into the SCARs and the things that are very AR-like, it was just good design, and it was very happen chance. Because I don't think that they were really thinking about it, but they're very quick and ergonomic rifles, and that's good design, and it's also probably a little bit of luck too, but it's great. They are do that. So when you put them on the clock, those rifles as for an individual competitor, those rifles will probably do the best. And, you know, but throwing shade on the others is ridiculous, because they are very formidable and capable weapons, and they've been used with outstanding success around the world. So while people who design two-gun action challenge matches may have their own opinions, which is fine, there's also a pile of just battle lessons learned, battle experience, saying how good these other weapons are. And they are quite good. And so they, what they like to poo-poo and throw shade on is not really an indicator of what the real world experience is. And therefore, you should take all that with a grain of salt. That's why I'm not even going to really watch the rest of it. It's like, yeah, okay, fine. We know what this is. The more AR rifle is, the faster it will be on the clock. Have a nice day. We'll see you around. Same kind of thing. There's a guy, and he's a good guy, the AK Operators Union 4774. He goes by Robsky. Apparently was born in Eastern Europe and is, I don't know if he's currently a U.S. Army infantryman. He's sort of, on his website, says he's kind of still in service, so whether he's on active duty or whether he's on reserve status, maybe a reservist or a National Guardsman, I don't really know. But, you know, and his stuff is very good, very entertaining. He does like to torture test AKs. He's big into AKs. He does like to torture test them. And one of the things that kind of pops up is, you know, some of the less expensive AKs probably don't hold up to his testing as some of the more expensive ones do. And I kind of look at that and say, that's all well and good, but the person who buys an AK in the United States, an AK-style rifle, is not going to fight with it. They're going to shoot it recreationally. I mean, now they are capable of defending yourself with and all these other things, but you're not really buying a rifle to roll across the steppes with and invade Western Europe. You're just not. So I don't know that they have to have the standard of durability that that say the former Soviet Union would demand. So I would say that these rifles, you know, I think there's such a thing as over-testing and over-stressing. And without running the numbers really quick, you know, I think, you know, to shoot 5,000 rounds through a rifle, even a battle rifle or an assault-style rifle, intermediate cartridge rifle like an AK, you know, 5,000, you just do the math. I mean, even at $100 a thousand, which is pretty low, it's really probably closer with shipping to $200 a thousand, I think is pretty close. So you go that by five times two, that's $1,000 worth of ammunition right there. I would say that most owners do not do that. Now, some professionals might, and some people who are really into it might, but 5,000 rounds is a lot. And to go 50,000 rounds, you're talking $10,000 worth of ammunition, which is probably more than what most people purchase in a lifetime, I would think. So it everything doesn't have to be, I guess, tier one operator approved or to that standard to be a successful rifle that's built on the AK design. That's just what I think. I think that, you know, I don't know, if I took an AK out, and I don't know how long it would last. I don't think I could wear one out doing the types of shooting I do. I just don't think I'd wear one out. So I think that a lot of times we worry about things that are not really needing to be worried about. So I think that, you know, look at some of this stuff on the internet with a grain of salt and realize that a lot of what they're selling you is perhaps capability that you're not really going to need and not really going to use. You know, here's an oblique example, a tangential example. But, you know, when I started shooting the NRL 22, basically, I have a very modest setup. but I can't even shoot to the capability of my modest setup. So therefore, you know, to buy, or and some of these rifle and scope combinations are running into the thousands of dollars, not just the hundreds of dollars, but the thousands of dollars. To me, that would be essentially wasted. I might do slightly better with a better optic. I might. But I also, it wouldn't be worthwhile for me to do that. It just wouldn't be cost effective. It would be much better for me to buy more ammunition and shoot the rifle I have and get better. And then if I get to the point where I say, you know, this optic or this rifle is holding me back, so I will I need something better. That's the point where you upgrade. And I don't know that I could ever reach that goal, probably. I just don't know that I could reach that goal because I put together a modest setup, but Savage makes good, accurate, and excellent rifles, and I think that they're real winners for what they are. I mean, definitely are. Okay, here's my favorite part of the podcast, questions and answers. And most of these are focused on holsters this time. So it says, how do you carry a Desert Eagle or large revolver? And that kind of came out of our the infamous bear attacks. So, you know, I would say that there's really two good ways to do this. If the large revolver has a short enough barrel, and that's usually under 6 inches, so 5 or 4, I think you can get away with a belt holster, especially if you're wearing suspenders as well, because you're putting a lot of weight on your belt, and since you don't want to look like a gangbanger with your pants around your knees, you know, that's the best way. That's a belt holster is really an excellent way to go. But some guns don't lend themselves to that, especially like the Desert Eagle or a long-barreled large revolver. And for those, I think a chest holster is a great option. A chest holster is a great option. What I've used the most for large guns like that is a large shoulder holster. Now remember, this is an environment where you're not concealing like Dirty Harry and pulling it out of your shoulder holster. It's not 1971 anymore. You know, when you're out in the woods, though, a shoulder holster is a good way to carry. I find it's a good way to carry a large revolver. And I think that you can even carry a Desert Eagle in that, especially if you have the ammunition on the other side to counterbalance it a little bit, have the pouch that's got the two magazines in it. And, of course, you have to attach these things to your belt, so they kind of help act as suspenders, too, and it kind of brings it all up. Those are ways to do it. The chest holster, I think, is a way to do it, but it's a challenge carrying a large revolver. I mean, they weigh a lot, and a large handgun, a Desert Eagle is not a revolver, but yeah, those are great big handguns, and they are a challenge to carry. And any holster that carries them that's going to be comfortable for you to wear for a long period of time is probably going to cost some money, somewhere north of $100 to $150 or about $200, somewhere in that. It's just, that's what it costs. So, you know, shop them carefully and look for all the there's so many brands out there, and most of them are, you know, the name brands are all very, very good. So I would definitely look for those. And one of the things you can do, like Car Arms, you know, they have the Desert Eagle line, and they essentially, you know, they'll have some holsters, you know, that they sell through their website, and things that are specially made for a Desert Eagle or specially made for their BFR revolvers. So that's the best thing I can do, shoulder or chest, depending on what you're doing. Okay, what are the most worthless holsters? Well, the most worthless design, the most worthless design is the old Buscadero Western holster. And I know these well because back in the 60s, during the heyday of the TV Westerns, my parents had Buscadero holsters, and I mean, we look just like Bonanza or you know, Gunsmoke or any of those ones in there where they all wore the Buscaderos. And the funny part was, as a kid, I didn't really know any better. And as I grew up, of course, and these things were hanging in the closet, I would try to use them. I was living on a cattle ranch at the time, and it's like they weren't comfortable to walk in. They really weren't comfortable to ride a horse with. They really weren't comfortable for anything unless you were just standing straight. The Buscadero is a terrible design. It puts the gun in exactly the wrong place, and it puts the gun belt at this weird, cocky angle, and you know, you have to tie it down to your leg, and it was just very odd. I mean, I guess it would work if you were fast drawing, but, you know, fast drawing is not smart, you know. People who do it with wax bullets or the, I guess they have plastic bullets for it also, but do it with those, because with live ammo, you can put a freaking hole in your leg or foot. So, you know, the Buscadero was just useless. I mean, it looked cool, and I mean, it had the cartridge loops on the back and all that, but it just was awful, and they still sell them today. I don't know who buys them. I don't know why you would buy them. I don't know who buys them. I don't even think they were authentic to the Old West. I think that if you go to Chisholm Trail or some of these other custom holster makers, you find much better authenticity-wise, and actually much better, just out of practicality, holsters to carry a firearm in. And I think a lot of that we owe to cowboy action shooters who kind of went after authenticity as opposed to the Roy Rogers sequin shirt and Buscadero holster type deal. So I think we owe them. They kind of shown that kind of the belt with the holster riding up high was probably the way to go. And if you look at historical holsters, that seems to be what they have. So I would say the worst one is the Buscadero. That's it. Best holster options. I think we talked, you can, if you're carrying an auto pistol and you're not concerned with concealability, the M12 UM84, the Bianchi Safari Land holster is great, and you can buy used examples on eBay, or I'm probably sure Gun Broker, and you can probably get for under $30. I think you can buy one, and they do a pretty good job. Now, it's not a full flap holster, so the butt sticks out a little bit, but it's good and secure. It's well made. It's proven. It's a good holster. Is it the fastest fast draw holster? No, but it's a good compromise between security and accessibility. So that's a good holster. That's a bargain out there today. It's a bargain, and they're going to be surplus for a while, and then they're going to dry up because that's what it is. And as I said in a previous cast, new ones they want $92 for. I don't think I would pay that, but other great options are El Paso Saddlery, and some of these other companies can turn out some really nice, authentic, whether they're period pieces, but they're still very, very useful today. A good full flap holster will keep your gun protected, and it's a joy to own quality piece of leather, quality holster. Some of the cheaper ones that you can get on these other sites, you know, buyer beware. If you're only going to use it once or twice a year, you can get by with one of those. But for serious work leather, that's what I would get. I would get something that's been made by a craftsman. That's definitely what I would go with. So those are the best holster options. Now, for concealability, I will turn that over to whatever is comfortable for you. But again, buying quality, comfort and quality and high price go hand in hand. So you may pay a lot, you may pay more than somebody else, but you'll be more comfortable and you'll have a better product in the background. For competition, I mean, there's everybody and their uncle is selling some kind of Kydex quick draw, you know, competition holster. And frankly, you can't keep track of them. it also becomes the gear race of this is that's last year's, this is this year's, and it must be you know, galaxies better, galaxies ahead of the one last year. So that whole thing, I would say that go see what the winners use and copy them. That's probably the best advice. Okay, worst holster options. This is not the most worthless holster. These are the worst options. I will say, and I'm going to beat on one manufacturer, anything that says Uncle Mike's or Hunter Holsters, personally put that in the back of your drawer. That's the kind of stuff you can wear once a year. It is not comfy. It is not that serviceable. It is cheap and it'll sort of work, but it's nothing that you're going to be able to use on a long-term basis. It just isn't. You know, I've seen these things. It's incredible to me that I see advertisements, and these aren't Uncle Mike's, but you see these holsters that are made out of, the ballistic nylon, and they want, $12 for a holster. First of all, I'm not going to put a $500 handgun in a $12 holster and expect it to work. And the answer is it doesn't. I saw guys mess with this stuff over in the sandbox. They buy a cheap holster, or mommy gives it to them before they go overseas, and literally within a week they're chucking it. They're throwing it in their duffel bag because it just doesn't work, or it's just not durable. Even though it's the ballistic nylon, it can tear. Is it stitched correctly? Is it even designed right? Does it even feel good? And the answer is most of that is stuff is just kind of junk. Most of it's made overseas. It's cranked out. And, it's fine if you're paintballing or air softing or something like that. It's fine for that. Fine for that. Or if you're carrying your BB gun around in it, it's fine for that. But, even there, if you use it a lot, it's just going to break and let you down. Good quality holsters do not do that. And, I'll be honest with you, anything you can buy out of Walmart is probably not what you want to be using for the long term. You get by with it here and there, and that's fine. But you really need to go and either shop, do some research online, or shop in a place like Cabela's or one of the large, outdoor stores that sells the quality stuff. And understand that when they ring it up, it's probably going to hurt. But 2 years from now, 5 years from now, you're going to say this was money well spent. It's money well spent. Cheap holsters to me are like cheap optics. You can get by with it, and if it's only for very occasional use, it's probably going to be fine. But eventually, it catches up with you. Eventually, it catches up with you, and that's just the way it goes. And you sit there and you say, well, I knew it when I bought it, but if you're only going to use it once a year, you can probably get by with it for a while, and then go from there. But the worst holster options I've seen are the cheap ones. And definitely anything made with a Tandy leather kit, unless the guy is a real craftsman, that's probably not a great idea either. So I have to tell a funny story. I bought a Colt Dragoon secondhand from a guy at a range, and it was a get together we had, and shooting was part of it. And I knew this guy, knew him real well. Well, he wanted to divest himself of it, so I purchased it, and it came with a Tandy holster and belt. Well, I was so proud of the gun, I just wanted to wear it the rest of the day, so I did. And this was made out of thin leather, and it held up. But holy cow, did my part of it was the weight of the gun, and the other part of it was just the poor design of this holster. It really wasn't a Buscadero. It was kind of a semi-Buscadero, which tells you right there that it was a bad design. My back ached the next day from hauling that thing around. And I realized, hey, I need a quality belt and holster for a handgun this large, because really the only thing larger than a Colt Dragoon is the Colt Walker, which is a, you know, a 4.5-pound handgun. And this was one of the Italian replicas, and it was not an expensive gun, but, you know, it looked very cool. I still have it, and I still really like it. But, man alive, that cheap holster just about killed me. And the worst part about a cheap holster is it looks cheap, and then it everything else just kind of looks cheap along with it, you know. So, anyway, worst holster options, cheap holsters, stuff made out of ballistic nylon that's chintzy put together, chintzy stitched, and also very cheap leather holsters, which, you know, a lot of times they just what they really do is take the finish off your gun. So that's kind of my take on those. Okay, here's the next question. Which gun, which is not on the market currently, would you like to have as a reproduction or as an original gun? Okay, there's two answers to that. If I'm talking small arms, and this is just my own kind of fun, what I would like to have is a very high quality, like something like, it would look like a Smith & Wesson Model 625, but it would be chambered for 50 GI, and it would basically be able to take a 50 GI auto rim type cartridge. It could fire them with a full moon clip, or it could take a 50 GI auto rim. It's the same as we have the 45 auto rim. That's something I'd really like. And I would probably like two versions of it. One would be the full on target version, like the 625. That would be very cool. And the next thing I would like would be maybe a classically styled one that looked just like a little bit larger end frame from, say, the 1920s or 30s, like a large 1917, just a little bit larger, 10% larger, something like that. Those would be very fun to have. So that would be for my small arms. If it's a gun of any type, and it's something that would be, you know, have to be attainable by me. I mean, it's not like, oh, I'd like a battleship gun. No, something that I could, you know, take apart and haul around that's not being currently made or is not really available except maybe to very advanced collectors. Just for my own interest in the First World War, I'd like to have a Model 1916 37mm cannon. You know, that's the gun that's in some very iconic pictures of the war. And it was a very useful gun because it was one of the few weapons larger than a rifle that you could take forward in the attack and knock out a machine gun nest with. So it was really very important. After the war, it really became completely obsolete. And by the 1930s, it was vanishing in the 1930s. They were actually using them for kind of subcaliber training devices for other guns. And by World War II, they were completely gone. But in World War I, it had a niche that it was portable enough and powerful enough that it could knock out a machine gun nest. So therefore, the Allies, the French and the Americans, I don't know if the British used it or not, but it was a very, very valuable gun for the Allies. It fit a niche and a specific use very, very well. So I'd like to have one of those. And I don't think, I think I'd actually like the original one of those that had a connection to that time period and a connection to the war. I don't know that a modern reproduction would float my boat very much. But anyway, that's the gun. That's a gun I'd like to have. The next question is related to it. What gun currently on the market would you really like to have, but is either too expensive or just not a priority right now, but it's a gun that's on the market that you'd really like to have, that you really admire? And of course, I kind of added a few things in that question, because usually if it's a gun on the market that you want to have, you have it, unless it's something fantastically expensive. That's interesting. I would have to say that just for the historical association, Winchester Model 1895 in 405 Winchester would be great. And we talked about one of those in the in an earlier cast, but that would be a fun gun to have simply because it's the style of rifle that Theodore Roosevelt used in Africa and killed lions with. I think that'd be pretty interesting. I've always liked the Model 95, and that would be pretty up neck and neck with, say, a 30-40 Krag modern version, like a military rifle version of an 1895 Winchester. I would like both of those. Those would be very, very cool. As far as other rifles go, if we're talking strictly kind of a sporting rifle, I think that it would be fun to own, and it would be a great conversation piece to own one of the CZ550 Safari Magnums in 416 Rigby and or 505 Gibbs. Those in 505 Gibbs, I think it's about a $3,000 price tag, and heaven only knows what that ammunition is. I know that for, you know, approximately $1,000, whether you buy new or used, you can get the 416, but its ammunition is quite expensive also. And, you know, it's not something you're going to shoot. But why would that be a fun rifle to have? And the answer is, you know, in talking about, you know, very large, dangerous game, you know, going back to bear attacks and other things, that's a, you know, that's kind of the last word. I mean, I know there's some long range cartridges that are very, very powerful and can actually dwarf it, but they're designed for long range target shooting. The Safari Magnums are designed really, you don't even need a scope on them. They've got leaf sights. They're designed for the close range knockdown of a very, very powerful beast. So that would be very interesting guns to own. As far as handguns, you know, there's not a lot interesting going on in handguns, although I would have to say that the Carr Arms white tiger striped Desert Eagle would be a lot of fun. I don't know that it's, I guess it's a practical finish. I guess it's just chrome, you know, hard chrome finish. So it's probably pretty durable, but it definitely will catch your eye, and it's definitely out there. And for $2,000 though, I would pass. It would be fun to have, but I don't know that you could do that. I think you can actually do better with that money. Is going back to the earlier thing, I think you could probably have a custom gunsmith crank out a nice, a 50 GI revolver on a, using a Ruger 480 or something as a platform. You could probably, with the $2,000, $3,000, probably have that done and have something that would be maybe a little bit more desirable. But the Desert Eagle has its fans, and it is a very desirable gun. So, and it's something that you can kind of buy off the shelf. That's pretty cool too. Well, that's it for another edition of Old School Guns. Again, you can try to hit those buttons, and I know one guy out there, Sharpshooter's been trying to do that, and he sent me a message on it. But all I can say is keep trying and keep going. You can now listen to us on iTunes, provided you can speak French. I don't think it's actually in French, but their email in French makes me wonder, so I'm going to have to try to go somewhere and find it on iTunes and listen to it to make sure it's on the up and up. So anyway, this is Old School Guns. We appreciate your listening to us. And again, hit the buttons and tell your friends and share this around. We have no sponsors. We're beholden to nobody. And we want as many people listening as possible. But, and so until next time, this is Old School Guns out.